Welcome back to The Civic Flame, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the legal side of our constitutional democracy and ask some serious questions about how the Constitution and democracy are or aren't playing nice together today. This week is a special episode because it's the first time we've had a request from a listener. Yay! Someone asked me to do a deep dive into one of my favorite legal documents in the United States, and that is the Kerner Commission Report. Before we get to it, though, you may have noticed that some of our social media have changed from Dr. Fun Sponge to Mother of Democracy. Between looking for a new job and getting my book ready to send back to the publisher, I realized that keeping multiple projects going wasn't going to work. And it wasn't really who I am. I don't do things in isolation because, to quote my girl Yoga with Adrian, it's all connected, baby. So I'm pulling my Birthzilla's maternal health and childbirth research stuff together with my Civic Flame and Dr. Fun Sponge stuff to talk about my two favorite things, women and democracy. And importantly, how hatred of women is incompatible with democracy. So that's how we get to the mother of democracy. For those of you here for more of the rule of law stuff, this week gets into one of the most important documents in U.S. history, and one of the few times a congressional report became a national bestseller, if you can believe that. So we're turning it back to 1968. Grab your bell bottoms and let's go. It's 1968. There's chaos everywhere. As one of my students who lived through it said, we went from Camelot in the 1960s to chaos in 1968. The Vietnam War is in full swing, as is the anti-war movement. The civil rights movement has fractured along different lines, including radical and militant lines. Dr. King has started to acknowledge that his dream was a dream, and is himself becoming more jaded with the inaction of what he calls the white moderate. But it's not all bad news. Otis Redding's sitting on the dock of the bay, and the Beatles' Hey Jude are topping the charts, and Planet of the Apes breaks onto the scene. Now, I could talk about 1968 all day long. Political culture, media culture, global culture, it's all there. From Dr. King's assassination to RFK's assassination, the Warsaw Pact invading Czechoslovakia, the Tet Offensive, President Johnson refusing the Democratic nomination, and then, during the Democratic National Committee meeting in Chicago, police riot and beat unarmed protesters while the delegates inside the convention hall come to fisticuffs themselves. My boy Dan Rather even gets knocked about a little bit. And that only takes us through August. You'll often hear historians refer to 1968 as one damn thing after another, because it was. And in the middle of all this, and at the center of some of it, sits the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, known as the Kerner Commission, named after Governor Otto Kerner of Illinois, who was the chair of the committee. This committee is established in 1967 by LBJ, that's Lyndon Baines Johnson, or President Johnson, for those of you who aren't history nerds, through Executive Order 11365, to investigate what were called the Hot Summers, or the riots and violence breaking out in the early 1960s. From 1965 to 1967, there were major riots, or rebellions, in some of the nation's cities, in particular, Newark and Detroit, which were a large centerpiece of the Kerner Commission report. The famous Watts riots occurred during this time, as did riots in Boston, Atlanta, and so on. After seeing this violence on the news, including the deployment of the National Guard, LBJ tasked the Kerner Commission with answering three questions. What happened? Why did it happen? What can be done to prevent it from happening again and again? Now, this is not unique in congressional history. Under Article 1, Congress has the power that is massive when it comes to investigations. But it is rare enough that the president started by asking a real question and not just having people go out and try to find what he wanted. They start with curiosity, and they went out and they found the evidence for their conclusion. In fact, they drew the conclusion from the evidence they found, as opposed to so often, especially today, when people find a conclusion they like and go out and find evidence that supports it. And you know they were looking for information, not just what they wanted to hear, because boy howdy, did they not want to hear what they found. They didn't hear it so much that LBJ refused to take a copy of the final report. This pissed off RFK Sr., the good one, not the dead bear carrying creeper who is still somehow the Secretary of Health and Human Services, that RFK Sr. decided to do what he said he wasn't going to do and challenge Lyndon Johnson, the sitting president, in his own party. This was not a thing in the 1960s or for decades before. It was simply not done, despite the fact that Gene McCarthy was successfully already doing it. So LBJ's reaction to this report reshapes the American presidential landscape in a big way, because it has ramifications on what really became one of the most important presidential elections in U.S. history in 1968 and shaped where we went for the entire future afterwards. What this also does, especially the report itself, is throw open for all the public to see the failures of LBJ's Great Society program in light of the Vietnam War. The Pentagon Papers come out a few years later and show the American people that the U.S. knew it could not win in Vietnam. Johnson knew it at the time, but he kept pouring money into it instead of his version of the New Deal, the Great Society. Johnson's lack of funding for the social programs he wanted to eradicate poverty and destroy segregation ended up making him just another white face coming to black voters, making promises they wouldn't deliver. Thank goodness we don't do that anymore. Lyndon Johnson could have stood out as one of the most liberal icons ever. His ability to help shepherd through the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, brought home to a lot of Americans, particularly Black Americans, rural Americans, and poor Americans, the possibility of the American dream. At the very least, political representation through voting, legal representation through civil rights laws, and the ability to live somewhere not based on the color of their skin. These were good things. These were things that should have put LBJ down in history. But his continual escalation of the Vietnam War, continuing to double down on the draft, and so many other things that were going on at the time really complicated his legacy. And when it came to all the good he wanted to do, he's often referred to as the flawed giant by historians. Because when it came to all that good he wanted to do, he didn't have the money to get it done. The opportunity that came out of the Kerner Commission report basically said, if we want to fund an end to segregation and violence in this country, it's going to cost as much in a year as the Vietnam War. Since we were funding the Vietnam War, that means we had the money to do it. But instead, even knowing we were not capable of winning that war, Lyndon Johnson chose to continue to fund the war and not fund the Kerner Commission report, the Great Society, and all those things that truly could have made the United States cast off that legacy of racial discrimination that we are still dealing with today. And when the Kerner Commission report gets reported on in the media, a lot of these things become clear right at the time. It becomes inescapable that police violence is the cause of a majority of these riots in the cities, that these riots are a response to an incidence of police violence, often against Black men. These riots or rebellions were not the work of random riffraff or troublemakers or bad actors. It was something far more dangerous. It was the result, as the Kerner Commission repeatedly reported to the American public, of a nation that was moving in two directions, one Black and one white, and that this segregation was only going to continue to have deleterious and disastrous effects on our society. Kerner showed that around half of the violence and half of the riots were directly started by the inciting incident that was police violence against Black community members. The American people wanted to know what was going on so badly that the Kerner Commission report became a bestseller, selling out 2 million copies right away Now, this is in a country with a population of 200 million at the time. Church groups were buying this book and getting it. Civic organizations like the Masons, the Elks, the Oddfellows are reading it. Town libraries, police departments, high schools are ordering copies. Folks were talking about it. In riots that would come over the years later, in the wake of the Martin Luther King assassination, in the wake of the Bob Kennedy assassination, even straight up through the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles in 1992, you heard people referencing the Kerner Commission. It became a cultural touchstone where a lot of Americans said, we have a roadmap to getting out of this. We have a plan. Why aren't we putting it into action? And as people read the pages, they continued to find uncomfortable truths about the U.S.'s treatment of Black Americans. The commission spoke about ghettos. And remember, this is a time when that term still heavily relates to the ghettos in Poland and elsewhere, where Nazis deliberately separated and impoverished those they deemed undesirable. So in 1960s, it was much clearer that this ghettoization was a deliberate policy choice to sequester people that society didn't care very much about. It was not seen as some random slang term for living in a poor neighborhood. The idea that this is on purpose, that this is structural, and that this is targeted was much clearer than it has become since. And throughout the discussion of police violence, holding community members without bail, shooting into apartment buildings, and so on, people began to get a view of what life might have looked like on the other side of the color line. The Kerner Commission report also did something remarkable. It answered that last question. It told us how to improve policing, how to stop riots, and how to invest in Americans. You know, all the stuff it was actually supposed to tell us, and all the stuff that LBJ's Great Society was supposed to do. It included the same conclusions we see and also don't fund today. Train the police to be members of the community, not military enforcers. There's a great TED Talk, if you get the chance, by someone called Chip Huth, H-U-T-H, and he's a police officer who discusses the way good training can take police who know that what they're doing isn't working and turn them into real community members who see people as people. There's also an Amnesty International article from 2014 that discusses the amount of American police departments who are being trained in Israel by the IDF. And here's the thing, the IDF is a military force. When you train the police with the military, you get very different policing than when you train the police as community members. Police are meant to serve community. The military deals with enemies of the state, usually foreign enemies or adversaries. When you train police in a military mindset, it creates a system where people who do not have the training and restraint that the military has now see problems the way the military does. They don't become community problems, they become threats, they become enemies. And we've seen over and over and over that this is a problem in a lot of areas. This is particularly complicated by the fact that since 2005, the FBI has regularly warned that white supremacists are infiltrating local law enforcement. There's the rise of the Constitutional Sheriff's Movement, an extremist organization that thinks they are the only constitutional legal law enforcement authority under the Constitution. There are so many issues with how police are behaving in communities, how communities cannot trust police, and against the backdrop of this fact that we've known at least since 1968 how to not do that, with things like militarizing the police through grants from the government to give them military equipment that then becomes something they have to pay to maintain, or with things like paying IDF and other organizations to train them, not only are we not putting money into training police the proper way, we're actually putting money into training them in a bad way, in an improper way. And so one of the things the Kerner Commission says early on is we should avoid doing that. We should be cautious. We may have missed the mark on that one. Other things that it suggests are things that you continue to hear. Put good paying jobs in all areas around the country. Put grocery stores in all areas around the country. We need more affordable housing, equitable schools, accessible public transportation, If you read the book, A View from Flyover Country, what you really start to see is something the author refers to as the post-employment economy, and the ways in which our current economic conditions give not just less social mobility, but less economic mobility to the next generation. My generation has less than my parents' generation. My children will likely have less social and economic mobility than I do. Employers, particularly corporations, routinely get away with not paying us. While the unemployment rate is reasonable, the underemployment rate, people who are not employed enough or who are employed in low-wage jobs and having multiple of those, is incredibly high. When we think about what it means to put good-paying jobs in areas, to put good schools in areas, to put grocery stores and affordable housing and public transportation in areas, we need to recognize that this is an economic choice. This is not a necessity. There's no magic wand that says, oh, we can't put money here because. Companies are making profits hand over fist, productivity is increasing, and yet increasingly, the American worker is thrown by the wayside. Not employed enough. We're draining rural areas of people through the opioid epidemic, but also through stealing up factory farm or family farms to create factory farms, underfunding colleges and universities and hospitals in those areas, underfunding educational institutes at K through 12. Education funding for higher ed is only 40% of what it was in 2008. And we wonder why so many students have student loan debt. So over and over, Kerner lays out the roadmap for the economic side of this. And we see that economic side not only not being addressed, but continuing to get worse in the last 30 years. The Kerner Commission also points out Black people and other minoritized groups deserve to be represented as people on the news and not just as random news stories. They deserve to be represented by reporters who look like them, by people who are from their neighborhoods, who talk to them and not at or about them. And you know, all that scary diversity, equity, and inclusion stuff we're still fighting out? Yeah, in 1968, Democrat and Republican members of the Kerner Commission figured it out. They wrote it down, they proved it, and they voted on it completely unanimously. And they said, this is the only way forward. In any kind of politically stable, morally just way that speaks to the highest of our American ideals, this is what we have to do. Fred Harris, the last living member of the Kerner Commission, does a short interview on NPR. I highly suggest it. I also suggest reading his book. He talks about how frustrating it was to have to come to these conclusions and somehow still not have these conclusions implemented. Harris and other members of the commission, including the first man, Black man, to have been elected to the United States Senate by popular vote, Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, have talked about how hard it was to go back to their families and their communities and try to explain. Harris noted his father was not a wealthy guy, and explaining why so much tax money had to be going to cities and to Black people, to his working-class, rural, white dad, made him realize the scope of the dialectical problem. This was going to be hard to talk about and convince people about, especially given the political conditions of the Vietnam War. Those conditions were certainly racialized. There were splits in how people viewed the college-educated, the urban versus rural, Black versus white. Under the best of circumstances, this was going to be a hard conversation to bring people into, and we were not in the best of circumstances. And it is still, as it turns out, the proper way to go forward. But every year we get farther into these problems and don't solve them. They become harder and more expensive. If we had started in the 1960s, it would have been so much more expensive and time-consuming than if we had started in the 1860s, when we should have seen a fully equal America after Reconstruction and the 14th Amendment. If we had started in the 1760s and gotten rid of slavery before we became a nation, we'd never have had to spend money on this. But what if we wait until 2060, 100 years after Kerner, 200 years after enslavement ends, and the social, political, and economic, and most of all, human toll of our failure to address these deliberate inequalities? will continue to be catastrophic. Well, that's all for this week. As if it weren't enough. There are so many other really cool congressional reports. Don't worry, I will absolutely go stuff myself into a locker on my way out of my office for the sheer amount of nerdy geekiness that just came out of my mouth. But honestly, if I had any artistic skill at all, I would love to turn these kind of reports into graphic novels because I think people would take some interest. But there is obviously the Warren Commission report on the Kennedy assassination, the 9/11 report, the January 6th report, and one really interesting one from the 1970s, the Church Committee report, which detailed the ways in which the CIA was spying on Americans and infiltrating anti-Vietnam War student movements. So if you want to learn more about those, let me know. Maybe I'll hook up another podcast about them. In the meantime, like, follow, and share this podcast, and follow us at our new home, Mother of Democracy, on Instagram and Blue Sky. Take care out there, and keep the civic flame burning bright. The Civic Flame is a Mother of Democracy production with writer Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. Thank you for listening.